This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is currently the 2nd of January 2011 here in Japan, although it is the still New Year's Day 2011 in the United States, where I'm joined on the line by Jim DiEugenio, the co-founder of the Coalition on Political Assassinations and co-editor of Probe magazine. He can now be found at the Citizens for Truth About the Kennedy Assassination at ctka.net. Jim DiEugenio, thank you for joining us today on the Corbett Report.
Okay, nice to be talking to you, Mr. Corbett.
All right, well, as listeners of our recent interview with John Hanke might remember, your name did come up in that conversation, and so Jimmy DiEugenio is here today to present his side of that story. But before we get into that specifically, perhaps you can begin by describing yourself and your background in the Kennedy assassination for those in the listening audience who might not be familiar with your work.
All right, in 1993, I published my first book on the Kennedy case, and that was called Destiny Betrayed, which was a kind of new look at the Jim Garrison investigation. After that, I co-edited and co-published Probe magazine, which at that time was a paper magazine that came out every other month with Lisa Peace. All right, and that went on for approximately 7 years, and that was that's pretty much regarded as the best journal ever created in this field. And we eventually ended up covering the Martin Luther King case, because at that time there was the Lloyd Jowers civil trial that took place in Memphis. And we actually had a reporter in the courtroom of that. We were the only publication to have a reporter in a courtroom there every day. And that was James Douglas, who later came to fame with his excellent book, JFK and the Unspeakable. We also covered the Scott Enyard trial. It was in Los Angeles. We were the only journal to have a reporter in that case, which dealt with the RFK case. If you're not aware, Scott Enyard sued to have his pictures back from the LAPD, which he took at the Ambassador Hotel the night that Robert Kennedy was assassinated, and he ended up winning that case. All right, and so we did this kind of stuff, which nobody else was doing, and we did this for approximately about 7 years. And then in 2003, we put together an anthology of what we considered some of our better articles, and that was a book called The Assassinations, Probe magazine on the JFK, MLK, RFK, and Malcolm X cases. All right, and that sold out the first edition, and it's going to be reprinted, I think, next month or the month after. Okay, and since approximately about 2006, we transferred a lot of the stuff that we had onto our website at ctka.net. So that's my background in this. Okay, and so I've roughly been doing it since approximately 92, 93. So that would make it roughly about 17 or 18 years. Some people consider me an authority on the King case and the RFK case. I really don't think I wouldn't consider myself a front rank kind of a researcher in those two cases, although I know them fairly well. I don't consider myself a front rank guy there. But I usually am considered on the JFK case. All right.
Right. So tell us about your work with CTKA and what type of work you do there.
Okay. See, one of the things that we try and do at our website, ctk.net, is we're kind of like a clearinghouse. Okay. We publish new articles. Okay. We publish new editorials. And one of the things we do is we review, books and documentaries, all right? And, because really nobody does this. So therefore, it's difficult to understand, to the average researcher or the average person, what constitutes good work and what constitutes bad work, okay? And so one of the things that we did is I did a very long multi-part series on Vincent Bugliosi's Reclaiming History, which, has met with a pretty big acclaim by the mainstream press. And because it's so long, I don't think very many people read it. It's something like 2,700 pages long. And I don't think very many people who reviewed that book read the whole book. Well, I did. Okay, and so I published a 10-part series on this, you know, which, you know, is an in-depth review of the entire book from every possible angle you could think of. You know, and so that's like one of the things that kind of put us on the map. Okay, so we criticize that, but we don't just criticize Oswald Didet books. Or documentaries. We also criticize conspiracy books. Okay, like I did a long review of Ultimate Sacrifice, the book by Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman. I also did a long negative review of the sequel to that, Legacy of Secrecy. Okay, and Lisa Peace did a review of, we discussed David Heyman's work on the Kennedys. He doesn't really deal a lot with the assassination, but he does some. We criticize his work. We just did a review by Joseph Green of Philip Nelson's book, you know, LBJ, Mastermind of the John F. Kennedy Assassination. Vince Palomero, who's probably the foremost expert on the Secret Service, did a review of both the Kennedy Detail, the book, and the documentary, which was on Discovery Channel. And we did a negative review of that. You know, I did a negative review of Russ Baker's book, Family of Secrets. Now, we've also praised some books. Okay, I did a pretty long review of JFK and the Unspeakable, okay, now, which I called one of the best books ever written on the JFK case. Martin Hay did a good review of Hear No Evil by Don Thomas. I did a good review of Breach of Trust by McKnight, Jerry McKnight, which I think is a very good book. And sometimes we do mixed reviews. Seamus Coogan did a mixed review of the Jesse Ventura special that was on True TV. Now, the reason we go after people who propose the conspiracy is because after 47 years, we think it's time to concentrate on the subjects and the people who we have the best evidence against. One of the problems with the whole JFK community is the multiplicity of suspects. And this is one of the things that Vincent Bugliosi uses to ridicule the critical community in his book, Reclaiming History, which I discussed this aspect of his book in part 10 of my review, which is the last part of that review that's available right now. I'll be working on a part 11, which will be the concluding part. Okay. So, you know, because we think that after 47 years, it's time to separate the wheat from the chaff. You know, like one of the things we went after with the Waldron Hartman book is the unfeasibility of saying that the mafia killed JFK. You know, the mafia might have been involved in a JFK case, but they certainly were not the prime movers, simply because when you examine the crime, okay, and who Oswald is, it's very difficult, you know, to fit the mob into that scenario. And most of the evidence that Robert Blakey came up with at the time of the House Select Committee has not stood the test of time. You know, it's pretty much been dissipated with the releases of the new documents by the Assassinations Record and Review Board. Maybe I should explain this, because I don't know how up to date and current your listeners are on what I just said. Robert Blakey was the second counsel brought in for the House Select Committee on Assassinations after Richard Sprague, the first counsel, had to leave simply because he was being attacked too much by the press and some of the congressmen for actually wanting to do a real investigation. Robert Blakey came in and did a kind of phony investigation. When he actually decided that there was a possible conspiracy, he tried to blame it on the mafia because that was his field of expertise before he came in. And he wrote a book right after this, right after the House Select Committee expired, in which he blamed the mafia for Kennedy's death. Well, what happened is when Oliver Stone's movie came out in 1991, 1992, this created such a furor with the public that, and in fact, the last title on the film was that the files of the House Select Committee are classified until I think it was 2053 or something. Okay, and so these were declassified finally. The Assassinations Record Review Board was the body set up to go ahead and declassify as many available documents as could be declassified, okay, at that time. And so a lot of the stuff the House Select Committee did has now been declassified, and we've seen that a lot of the things that Blakey tried to put together to put together this mob did it scenario have not stood up to scrutiny. All right. And in fact, almost all of it has not stood up to scrutiny. All right. So when Waldron and Hartman try and recycle this, we criticize them for this in light of the new documents, you know, that have the ARB has declassified. See, one of the things that Probe did, which nobody else did, is we actually had people in certain fields, like, for example, Gary Aguilar, who's a doctor up in the San Francisco area. Well, he was very interested in the medical evidence. So he would read some of these documents and write articles for us. Millicent Craner was another person who was very interested in the medical evidence, okay, from New York. And she did stuff on the declassified documents and medical evidence. We have a guy named Bill Davey, who lives in, I think, the Maryland area, who's very interested in Jim Garrison. Well, he looked at the ARB documents that were declassified on Garrison and wrote articles for this. So we were really the only journal that was current on these thousands and thousands of pages of declassified documents on the JFK case. And this is why when Oliver Stone did his two-disc DVD version of JFK, he asked me to do an audiovisual essay, you know, and it's on the second disc of that, and it's called The New Documents, in which I went ahead and talked about what was in these newly declassified documents, all right? So this is the kind of thing that we do, because we think, like I said earlier, that, you know, 47 years is long enough, you know, not to be confused about this case anymore, all right?
Right, and I certainly think the point is well taken, and I don't think anyone who's being reasonable would disagree with that point, certainly, because it certainly is time to really narrow it down to what we have for the best available evidence, and of course that begs the question, what is the best available evidence that we have, and who does it point to?
Okay, well, what we've done, like one of the things I did in my Bugliosi series is, I think that's in Section 5, I took a lot of the best work that's been based on these new documents, all right? And one of the things that we did is I put together what I believe is a really kind of supportable scenario about the conspiracy and the cover-up, okay? And what I did is I essentially traced the summer of 1963, you know, to the fall of 1963, using the work of people like John Newman and Bill Davey. John Newman is a former military intelligence analyst who worked on the film JFK and wrote two groundbreaking books on this case, JFK in Vietnam, which I think was published in 1992, and Oswald and the CIA, I think, which was published in 1995 or 96, in which he went through, at that time, the declassified files by the Central Intelligence Agency on Lee Harvey Oswald. And he came up with some very, very, very interesting discoveries in that book. So what I tried to do in that essay is trace what I thought was the best evidence for what had happened from, say, the summer of 1963 to November and a little bit after November to try and explain how the cover-up worked, you know, also. And what I put in there essentially was I felt that this was essentially before the crime. You know, this was very likely a CIA operation led by people like James Angleton and David Phillips and probably Howard Hunt in a supporting role. I think Angleton was essentially running the thing at CIA HQ, and I think Phillips and to a lesser extent Hunt were running the manipulation of Oswald, okay, from New Orleans, okay, to Mexico City, which is really, really, really important, okay, the whole operation that went down in Mexico City, which John Newman did an absolutely fantastic job elucidating, okay? And then, as you get into Dallas, the actual assassination itself, you know, which I don't really like to talk about because, in my opinion, that's where you get in kind of trouble because, in my view, you're never really going to know, you know, who the actual assassins were. Okay, it's way too late. you know, to figure out who that was, okay? But I think, you know, the fact that David Phillips told his brother in a kind of deathbed confession, you know, that, you know, he asked him, I think his name was James, you know, because they had become estranged towards the end of Phillips's life over this particular issue, because Phillips was such a horrible anti-Kennedy guy that his brother just got sick and tired of listening to him. And when he was dying, you know, he asked him, he goes, you know, were you in Dallas on November the 22nd, 1963? And according to his brother, Phillips said that he was. All right. So, you know, so it's this kind of stuff. Plus, I think the cover-up, according to this fantastic work by Carol Hewitt, a lawyer in Florida, it clearly implicates Ruth and Michael Payne. Okay. I don't know if you do. Should I talk a little bit about who they are?
Please do, yes.
Okay. All right. Ruth and Michael Payne are these kind of friends of George de Morenschild. George de Morenschild miraculously became Lee Harvey Oswald's best friend when Oswald returned from Russia. Okay. And I think that was in the fall of 1962. And so you have this spectacle of this supposed communist who really doesn't have a lot of money. He's not very cosmopolitan, former Marine, returns to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and suddenly he's befriended by a guy named George de Morenschild, who was a kind of the best way to talk about this guy. He was very, erudite, very charming, very much a ladies' man. I think he'd been married four times, okay? And, you know, was the kind of guy who, you know, he could very justly see, you know, playing Baccarat in Monaco, okay? He was that kind of savoir-faire and that kind of a worldly kind of person, had all kinds of connections, even to the family of Jackie Kennedy, all right? And so you have this spectacle of this guy who, by the way, he's a white Russian. And the white Russians, of course, were the people in the Soviet Union who had opposed the Marxist-Leninist revolution of 1917 and 1918. And a lot of these people were gotten out of Russia, and they were by the United States government, and later on they were supported by the Central Intelligence Agency, you know. And the white Russians, there was a small community of them in the Dallas-Fort Worth area at the time. Well, de Morenschild, out of the blue, befriends this kind of Wastrow guy, Oswald, and he introduces him to two of his friends, Ruth and Michael Payne. As de Morenschild leaves the scene, I think he left for Haiti in April of 1963. Okay, suddenly, Ruth and Michael Payne then become the best friends of Marina and Lee Oswald. And in fact, Ruth Payne actually picks up Marina from New Orleans in the fall of 1963, brings her back to the Dallas area. And Marina, and essentially what she does is she estranges Marina from Lee, okay, in those last couple of months before the assassination. But she does one other thing. Her garage now becomes the kind of warehouse for Lee Harvey Oswald's belongings, because he then rents this very small, I think it was a one-room apartment at 1026 North Beckley in the Dallas area. So now, what happens, of course, is right after the assassination, the police go to Ruth and Michael Payne's home. Ruth throws open the door, lets them in, says words to the effect, I've been expecting you. Her and Marina leave, and they essentially get the run of the Payne household, digging out almost anything they want to do. But that's not enough, because there were some things that only Ruth Payne found weeks later. I mean, she was supplying evidence for a good solid week and a half, okay, after Oswald was arrested and even after he was killed. For example, what some people don't know, there's these famous backyard photographs that are supposed to be of Oswald taken by Marina, okay, in the spring of 1963, all right? Well, when the police went to the Payne household and they went ahead and made their inventory of the evidence found, guess what? That particular camera was not found. It's called an Imperial Reflex camera. That camera is not on the Friday or Saturday evidence report the Dallas police went ahead and filed. That camera was not found until 9 days later by Ruth Payne, because the cameras that were on the first day inventory report could not produce a picture of the dimensions that those pictures are, the alleged backyard photographs are. Now, what does Ruth do when she finds this camera? Does she give it to the FBI? Does she give it to the Dallas police? No. She gives it to Robert Oswald, who, by the way, at this time, Marina Oswald is staying with. And slowly but surely, after visits by the FBI, Marina begins to change her mind about the cameras that Lee Harvey Oswald had until she finally testifies, I think in June of 1964, before the Warren Commission, that, oh, yeah, now I recognize this camera, this pure reflex camera. That's the camera that I use, except there was one problem. When the House Select Committee questioned her about this, they asked her, all right, on this Imperial Reflex camera, which you say you took the pictures of Oswald in the backyard, okay, is this the kind of camera that when you go ahead and frame the picture and focus it, is it the kind of camera that you bring up to your eye, or is it the kind of camera that you look down into your waist? See, back in those days, I don't know how old you are, but I'm fairly old. Back in those days, you had certain cameras that you went ahead and focused the picture by holding the camera at your belt buckle. You looked down into the viewfinder instead of looking it through your eye at eye level. Well, Marina gave the wrong answer. She said she lined up the shot by raising the camera to her eye. Wrong answer. And that kind of camera, you look down at your waist. Okay? So this is one of the things that Ruth Payne, and she also, the Warren Commission was having a terrible time trying to prove Oswald was in Mexico City. Okay? And Richard Russell, one of the commissioners, was balking at signing the report because he said, what's the evidence we have that he was there? Well, Ruth Payne, again, a few days later, comes up with supposed evidence, okay, like a map, okay, and tickets to a sporting event, that somehow proved that Oswald was supposed to have gone in Mexico City, all right? And I could go on and on. Well, Ruth Payne, if you can believe this, if you count the questions that all the witnesses were asked before the Warren Commission, all right, the person asked the most questions was Ruth Payne, okay? Which is kind of weird because she is not a witness in any way, shape, or form to the actual crime. You know, you would think that, you know, like, well, wait a second. What about, for example, the autopsy doctors? Wouldn't they be, like, really important, especially with all the problems we've had with this? No. It's Ruth Payne. So this is, I make the case there that I believe that, and there's another connection there. The kind of Mary Bancroft was a close friend of Alan Dulles. She had been a spy for him in Switzerland during World War II when Dulles was in the OSS, okay? And she became his kind of girlfriend, even though, of course, Dulles was married. Well, Mary Bancroft was a close friend of Michael Payne's mother, okay? And Alan Dulles was in Dallas 3 weeks before the assassination, and he actually joked his friends, words to the effect, you know, wouldn't those conspiracy buffs have a field day if they knew that I was in Dallas 3 weeks before the assassination and one of my former employees was a close friend of Oswald's landlady, okay? So these are kind of, I truly believe that if the case is ever reopened, okay, these are people who happen to be still alive that should be called to the stand and asked to explain any number of things. Okay, so that's roughly speaking on how I think the actual assassination occurred. Okay,
right, and of course there is a multiplicity of evidence to go into, but I think that's a good summary.
Yeah,
so
we could be here for like 3 hours.
Exactly. So suffice it to say, there's
Mexico City. We could talk about Mexico City for an hour.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? But suffice it to say, there is a multiplicity of evidence that points to CIA involvement in the assassination.
Yes. Yes. Right.
Okay. Well, I think that might be a good spot to shift into the next stage of the conversation, which is to respond to some of the things which were said in the interview with John Hankey that we had earlier. I'm not sure if you'd like to start this or if you'd like to bring in the author of the article from CTKA.net, The Dark Legacy of John Hankey, Seamus Coogan, at this point of the conversation.
Okay. Can I just make some general points and we can bring in Seamus a few minutes later?
Sure, please do.
From his essay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. See, one of the reasons that our site has gotten a lot of fans, okay, through the years, you know, because you know we do really thorough work, and so people alerted me to some of the things that John Hankey was saying about me. All right, you know, and one of the things he was insinuating about me was that somehow I'm some kind of deep cover, you know, agency operative, you know, on it, which. I don't understand this at all because I don't believe anybody could ever read any of my stuff and somehow say that I'm some kind of cover, I'm protecting the CIA. I mean, very, very few people in this case have been adamant, as I have been, about accusing the Central Intelligence Agency of being, you know, behind at least the main operating force behind the Kennedy assassination. So, you know, this is what I have, you know, this is one of the things that I object to. Secondly, Seamus' article, he is trying to characterize it as a hit piece. In traditional terms, a hit piece means something like this with the traditional media. You have these higher-ups in the media chain. They call in a guy they know is pliable. They say, look, we want you to go ahead and knock down this story or smear this person. And then he has carte blanche to go ahead and do this job. And I can give you example after example on this. When NBC went after Jim Garrison in 1967, that's exactly what happened. Walter Sheridan was given carte blanche. He was the producer of that terrible TV show. And he went after Garrison. Okay. Another example would be Richard Sprague in 1975. The New York Times sent David Burnham, okay, after Richard Sprague, you know, and they did a 5-day series on the first Council of the House Select Committee, and then they culminated with an editorial that Sprague should step down. Okay, see, that's the traditional meaning of a hit piece. Well, I don't understand how. See, I never originated this article. Seamus was looking at it online at this JFK 2 movie, and he had seen it, and he started emailing me questions. You know, Jim. Did he or did he not okay the Bay of Pigs invasion? Things like that. Because these are the kind of things that are in that film. I mean, Hankey's trying to say that Kennedy never okayed the Bay of Pigs invasion, which is a ridiculous statement. I mean, all you have to do is look in Trumbull Higgins' book, The Perfect Failure. Okay, and he gives you the exact meetings. And in McNamara's book, in retrospect, he talks about the meeting, which I think was on April the 4th, 1961. Where Kennedy actually took a vote of his cabinet to okay the invasion, all right? And then he told the CIA that up to 24 hours before, I reserved the right to cancel. Okay, well, he never canceled it. That order was never sent. So to say that Kennedy did not okay the Bay of Pigs invasion is simply not true. It is true, and it's documented. So Seamus was going ahead and firing me these questions, you know? And I said, well, where are you getting this stuff? And he said, well, I'm looking at this movie, JFK 2, by this Hankey guy. I go, he's really saying this stuff? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, you think I should write an article about this? And I said, okay, I actually think you should. So Seamus did the article. See, that's how it originated. It's not somebody doing a hit job. It's just somebody watching a piece of work and getting outraged at all the mistakes that are in it. Because like I said, you know, we kind of take this stuff seriously. So if somebody makes a plethora of mistakes, you know, then we're going to say something about it. You know, or somebody's going to say something about it, and we'll go ahead and print it. So it was not in any way, shape, or form what you could consider, you know, in any kind of a hit piece. And for Hankey to say, as he did on your show, that we found one mistake in this, that Mossadegh actually was not killed in the CIA coup in 1953, that's a complete misrepresentation. In that particular section of the early version of JFK too, just to show you, he makes another mistake, and he clearly implies that Arbenz was killed in a 1954 CIA coup in Guatemala. Again, that is not true. Arbenz did not die. He died in exile, I think, in Mexico City in 1971. All right? But the whole litany of mistakes that he made are detailed by Seamus in his article. In fact, I actually, when I got into an online debate with Hanke, I went through the first 45 minutes of the film. And I listed something like 35 to 40 mistakes. To give you another example, he puts words in Bill Colby's mouth that he said before the church committee, which Colby did not say. All right? So this is a complete mischaracterization on his part. And by the way, in the debate I had with him, he admitted this at first, that he was kind of ashamed that he made so many errors. He's now revised his position. He has a new kind of limited hangout position by attacking us and saying he only made one mistake, which is, we'll talk with Seamus about this later. Okay. Now, one of the things I truly object to, he tries to imply that somehow what I'm doing is protecting George H.W. Bush. Now, if you know anything about me, I firmly believe the whole Bush clan should be in jail. Okay, that's George H.W. Bush, Jeb Bush, and George W. Bush, our former president. Okay? I just don't believe they should be in jail for this. I think George H.W. Bush should be in jail for the October surprise and the Iran-Contra scandal. Okay, especially the latter, because he was obviously involved with the kind of mini Operation Phoenix thing down against the Contras in Nicaragua. All right? And of course, then he had to go ahead after Lawrence Walsh indicted 13 people. He had to pardon half of them because he knew if those people all went to trial, the trail would lead to himself and he'd be indicted. Okay? I think Jeb Bush should be in jail for two things. The drug running out of Florida to Nicaragua and the war against the Contras, which is a lot of evidence that he was involved in. And number two, his role in stealing the Florida in a 2000 election, which helped his brother, you know, become president when Al Gore should have won that election. I think his brother, George W. Bush, should, I mean, I don't agree with Vincent Bugliosi on the Kennedy assassination, but I do agree with him about his book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, because I believe that he was a witting participant in all the false premises that led to this war against Iraq, which has resulted in a death of at least over 100,000 Iraqis, and about 5,000 Americans, okay? So I believe the whole clan should be in jail. I'm not protecting them at all. I'm just saying that the evidence that that people like Hanke and people like Russ Baker produce to say that George H.W. Bush was somehow the ringleader in the Kennedy assassination will not stand up to scrutiny. I want to get this case. We finally have a guy in Dallas named Craig Watkins who was open to the idea that the Kennedy case is a conspiracy. And it's probably going to be the last best hope we ever have of getting this case before a grand jury. I'm just saying that if you gave Craig Watkins Hanke's movie, I mean, what do you think would happen? Nothing. There isn't anything there that you could actually, what are you going to do? I'm going to indict you on the basis of this movie. You know, that's what we're about. Okay, Ruth and Michael Payne are still alive. Wesley Frazier, okay, is still alive. Two of the autopsy doctors are still alive. Okay, and that's how you try to build to reopen this case. All right.
Absolutely. Okay, so you mentioned the online debate between you and Hanke. Where can people go to actually read that?
I don't know if it's still there. It was at JFK Murder Solved. Okay, that website. Now, what Hanke did on his website is he excerpted my reply, okay, to his original long defense, all right? But what he didn't do is he didn't put my second installment on there. He left that out because that's the part where I listed all the errors and explained where they were in his film. He left that out. He didn't put that on his website because that counteracts his whole argument that somehow there was only one mistake in JFK too. Okay, but that's where it is, if it's still there. I'm not sure if it's still there, okay, at JFK Murder Solved. All right, so, see, some of the things that that Seamus brought up were very easy mistakes that you really didn't have to do any heavy-duty research about. Some of it was online. Some of you just could have gone down to your public library, you know, and looked up to get the true facts, you know, which obviously Mr. Hanke didn't do. For example, in one of the installments of this, you have to understand, before he changed the name to Dark Legacy, all right, he had gone through about three or four different versions of JFK 2, all right, and a lot of them were online. Seamus found the one that he thought had got the most views on YouTube, and I think this is the one that Alex Jones markets on his website. So that's the one that Seamus decided to concentrate on. For example, in that, Hanke said that Oswald was seen by Guy Bannister's secretary at the Link Punch and Train training camp in the summer of 1963. Well, all you have to do is look in Tony Summers' book, Conspiracy, and you'll see that, no, what happened was that Miss Roberts, who was Guy Bannister's secretary, told Tony Summers in an interview he did with her that she saw Oswald at Guy Bannister's office. You know, and this is more or less depicted in Oliver Stone's movie, JFK. All right? So, no, this did not. In fact, to my knowledge, there is no witness who saw Oswald at the Lake Punch and Train training camp. Now, there is some evidence that Oswald was there. But it's not what Hanke says it is. There's Bob Tannenbaum, the first deputy counsel for the House Select Committee, said in the interview he did with Probe Magazine that he saw a film, okay, and with somebody who looked like Oswald at that training camp. But it's not what Hanke says it is. All right, another thing that Hanke does in that film, like I said earlier, He couldn't figure out what the name of the church committee was, which is really amazing. He called the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, which at that time there was no such thing. See, the church committee, which was investigating the crimes of the CIA in 1975, eventually became the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Okay, but there was no such committee at that particular time. So he has Bill Colby, you know, appearing before that committee. And he literally puts words in his mouth that somehow he had given away, you know, some of the secrets of the Kennedy assassination, okay, to that committee. But everyone knows that that committee in public testimony never even talked about the Kennedy assassination. The work of the church committee on the Kennedy assassination was done by a subcommittee that did not meet in public. And that subcommittee was composed of Gary Hart and Richard Schweiker. And to my knowledge, Colby never even appeared, okay, before the Schweiker-Hart committee. All right, and then at the end, and this was something that really was quite bizarre, at the end, he actually has Bush going into Hoover's office with two Cuban enforcers. And he makes up this scenario about Bush threatening to kill Hoover, you know, with a poison dart gun, a flechette. All right? You know, and as Seamus said, there's absolutely no evidence, not only for this ever happening with Bush, but there's no evidence for anybody ever doing this to Hoover in his entire career, you know? And he just kind of created this, like, out of thin air. If you read any of the biographies of Hoover, and there's about four really good ones as of today, you know, there's one by Tony Summers, and there's one by Kurt Gentry. And that's the one I use most of the time, because I think that's very, very reliable. There's one by Athon Theo Harris, and there's one by Richard Gid Powers. None of those books ever mention any such a thing happening. And you're talking, between those four books, you're talking like over 2,000 pages. You know, and then you go ahead and look at the footnotes. It's impossible to believe that nobody would ever speak of anything to any of those authors in all the years that it took to compose those works.
So absolutely. Well, to be fair, I don't think I at least when I was watching that documentary, and I believe I watched that version, which is mentioned in The Dark Legacy of John Hanke about 4 years ago now online. And I at that time, it was absolutely clear to me that this was completely speculation. It was not, he was asserting that there was any documentary record whatsoever for this actually happening.
And what he does in the film, he prefaces this by saying words of the effect, you know, if you can't find a reason for this memo to exist, then you have to go ahead and accept my reason. And Seamus actually brings this up in the essay. Okay? You know, so he, yeah, you're right. He's not saying that it documentary evidence it happened, but he's saying the odds are that it did happen. Okay? That's how he tries to explain it. Now, he cut it out of the new version, Dark Legacy, you know, which I actually saw. Okay, and I think that's probably one of the reasons he did it, because he probably got too many people saying, you can't insinuate, however underhanded you want to, that this event happened, okay, because there isn't any evidence that it did happen. So you can't say that the odds are that it did, when there really isn't anything that says it did. Okay, so I think that's the reason that he took it out. All right? Now, another thing that he tries to insinuate in this film is somehow that this memo that Hoover wrote, which, by the way, has been around since 1988, Joseph McBride, this independent writer, found it, and he wrote an article about it in The Nation way back in 1988. You know, you're talking like, you know, this is like 22 years old. I think Hanke's film came out in 2004. Russ Baker's book came out, I think, 2008 or 9. So this thing has been around for literally decades, you know. And it says, and Seamus links to it in his article, you know, that the FBI alerted Bush and another guy. The other guy was, I think, was DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, and George Bush of the CIA, that there was some rattling around in Florida, okay, that somehow they should attack Castro, okay, in the wake of the Kennedy assassination, all right? Now, this, what Hanke does with this memo is what McBride originally did in his articles in The Nation. He essentially says, number one, okay, that clearly it appears that George Bush was not being honest in his hearings, okay, before the Congress, when he said he had never been employed or associated with the CIA before he became CIA director in 1975. And I think he was director for like a year or maybe a little bit less than that. Okay. And then he leaves it open like a responsible journalist would. He says, you know, this does not really mean that Bush actually was an employee of the CIA, because there's all kinds of business people that the CIA uses as what is the term is called assets. In other words, they do them favors in certain situations. All right? Okay, so that's what McBride said. And that is the only objective reading of this document. Okay? Now, he tries to make a big deal about the file title, which is called The Assassination of John F. Kennedy. See, what he doesn't tell the reader is this, that whenever the FBI opens an investigation, as they did in the JFK case, every document that goes into that file has that title, whether or not it's actually concerned with the circumstances of JFK's death or not. Now, anybody will tell you who studied the FBI investigation of John F. Kennedy, the last thing that J. Edgar Hoover was interested in was who killed John Kennedy. Within 24 hours of the assassination, Hoover had closed the case, all right, within 24 hours. It was all over. Okay, Oswald had killed Kennedy. In fact, the next day, you would think he was really worried about who killed Kennedy. It was a Saturday. He would have gone to FBI headquarters and worked on this. He didn't. He went to the racetrack with Clyde Tolson, and he took calls on the case out of a special phone that the racetrack had set up for him. So Hoover didn't give a damn who killed John F. Kennedy, and he did everything he could to cover it up. And he later admitted this. Okay, it's in Tony Summers' book. When a friend of his met him at the racetrack and asked him, I think it was in April or May, so the Warren Commission had been in the session for about 6 months, and he asked him, and he goes, what really happened with the Kennedy assassination? And he said words to the effect, if I told you, you wouldn't want to believe it. Okay? So obviously, if Oswald did it, Hoover wouldn't have said that. Okay? So Hoover knew that by at least April or May, probably earlier than that, there was a conspiracy and he was involved in the cover-up. So the idea that this document carries weight because of its title, when I said this is standard operating procedure for the FBI to have the same title in every document, and B, Hoover never looked for who was killing Kennedy. Okay, it makes absolutely no sense, you know. And I believe what that is doing is deliberately inflating, you know, the value of this particular document. See, Bush, and this is what most people believe, Bush was probably used as an asset through his Zapata Oil Company for the Bay of Pigs, because I'm pretty sure that this is correct. Zapata had a rig off of the island of Quetzal, which I think was 40 miles north of Cuba. Okay, so the likelihood is that the CIA asked him if they could infiltrate some material for the Bay of Pigs by using, you know, his possessions on this island of Quetzal. All right, and this is probably some Cubans who went there and made the preparations for this, and Hoover, you know, probably knew about this. Because although the FBI steered clear of interfering with any CIA operations, they did have guys in New Orleans and Miami who Hoover picked because they spoke Spanish, and they talked to these Cubans, and they had very good relations with them. In New Orleans, it was a guy named Warren DeBreeze, you know, who knew everything about what these Cubans were up to. So this is very likely how Hoover learned about Bush's cooperation in the Bay of Pigs. And he might have been used probably in Mongoose also, okay, which was the secret war against Cuba that lasted, I think, from, what was it, March of 1962 till October of 1962, okay? And if you're a responsible researcher, that's what the document says. That's it. How it implicates Bush in the Kennedy assassination, I don't see how anybody can read that document and come to that conclusion. I really, really don't. It simply does not. Okay?
Right. Now, so to be clear what that document does state, it does state that George Bush was involved in this, and we can be reasonably certain that it is George H.W. Bush, and not another George Bush. And
I don't. You know, the CIA did a really stupid thing. I'm. You know what I'm going to say, right? They tried to say that somehow this was not George H.W. Bush.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. See, after the story came out, the CIA did something they almost never do. Yeah, because they usually, when something like this happens, they'll say, we will neither confirm nor deny the story. Okay. Well, what they did is they actually tried to say that this really was not George H.W. Bush. And there actually was another George Bush in the CIA at the time. Well, McBride tracked the guy down, all right? And this is ridiculous. You know, this couldn't possibly be me. Okay, I was never in the CIA involved with these, you know, these Cuban operations. You know, I was a lowly, I think what he said, wasn't he a map maker or something? Or something like that?
I don't know off the top of my head, but that sounds about right. It was certainly a low-level position.
Yeah, it couldn't possibly be him, all right? So it would have to be, well, unless there's a third George Bush in the CIA that the CIA didn't know about, okay, it would have to be George H.W. Bush, all right? Okay, so that's, to me, that's about the extent of this document which I believe Baker and Hanke have inflated. Now, what they've tried to say, especially Baker, okay, in his book Family of Secrets, they've tried to inflate this thing to say that somehow George H.W. Bush was actually a CIA officer, and not in 1961 at the Bay of Pigs. Baker tries to put his employment way the hell back in the late 1950s, which would be okay with me if you had any kind of evidence that showed that this was the case. But what Baker does is he goes to these books by a guy named, in my review of Baker's Family of Secrets, okay, I discuss this in depth. He goes to this guy named Joe Trento, who wrote these two books. The first one was called The Secret History of the CIA, okay, and the other one was called Prelude to Terror. Trento is essentially a kind of, before Angleton died, okay, James Angleton. Trento was essentially a friend of James Angleton. And if you take a look at his books, and this is something Baker doesn't tell you, Trento essentially follows the line that James Angleton followed on the Kennedy assassination, namely that Oswald really was a KGB agent when he was in Russia. They converted him, okay? And then when he came to the United States, he eventually fell in with Castro. And therefore, Oswald killed Kennedy. And this is the oldest CIA cover story in the book. When Oswald actually killed Kennedy, which of course he did not, he was doing it for the commies, okay? And which, of course, everyone, you know, I'm sure you believe this, you know, Oswald really wasn't a communist anyway, okay? So this is nothing but a cover story to disguise, A, the circumstances of the murder, and B, who Oswald really was. Well, see, this is the kind of stuff that Trento uses, and he's a very CIA-friendly author. Now, Baker uses him to say, for example, that in the late 1950s, Bush was recruited for Mongoose. Well, in my review, I said, this is impossible, because Mongoose did not start until 1962. And I think it was February the 8th, you know, Shackley is sent down to Miami to prepare for Mongoose. It doesn't actually get started operationally until March. So the earliest you could say it started was in February 1962. So whoever was funneling this information to Trento got his date screwed up, okay? It simply could not happen that way. But this is the argument that they try and make, and which I say, which would be fine with me if you had any credible evidence that says that this was the case. It was not. Now, let's get to the actual, because when Hanke was on your show, he said that there was something that was pure gold in Baker's book. There was this notice in the Dallas Morning News that Bush was going to be in the area, I think, on the 21st. All right.
Right. I believe you said Dallas specifically.
Well, see, this is the problem with him saying that. Bush was running for the Senate at the time. Okay? He was running in a Republican primary, which was going to be, I think, in March. So in November, he and his wife were on the campaign trail. They were hitting all the cities in East Texas. So, of course, you want people to know that you're going to be there, all right? So you put a notice in the paper hoping that people will show up. So my question is this. If you're a CIA operative involved in the assassination of President Kennedy, why would you be stupid enough to advertise it in a newspaper the day before? All right? Now, what Baker does with this in his book, Family of Secrets, is simply breathtaking. And I really had to read this over twice to understand what he was trying to say. Baker is trying to say that when Bush was running for the Senate in the primary in 1963, 1964, he really wasn't running for the Senate. In other words, this was supposed to be his cover for his role in the Kennedy assassination. Which, when I read this, I realized to myself, I go, you know, this is like Lamar Waldron and his Mob Did It thing. No matter how stretched, no matter how illogical, okay, the circumstances are. These guys are determined to fit them into their theory, even when any logical person would say they do not. Why would you have to do that if you're involved in the Kennedy assassination? To me, it'd be stupid. A covert operator is a covert operator. We didn't find out that David Phillips was in Dallas until he was going to die. Okay? So this, to me, does not make any sense. All right? Now, the other thing is that when Baker in his book says something like, he told the FBI that he was going to be staying at the Sheraton on the evening of the 22nd, but he didn't stay at the Sheraton on the evening of the 22nd. See, I think what Baker's trying to imply there is that somehow Push was involved in getting the assassins out of Dallas or something, you know, because he was using a plane that a friend had to fly around East Texas. Well, I said in my review, well, Rush, I mean, don't you think that the events that occurred in Dallas on the 22nd kind of put a damper on his campaign stop? I mean, do you really think that anybody was going to show up, okay, you know, to this Republican primary campaign when Kennedy had just been assassinated? All you have to do is look at the films of Dallas, what was going on that day and that night. I mean, people were going crazy. People were in a state of mourning. People were going to church. All activities were called off, you know? I mean, Oswald was still in jail. The media had descended upon the town. Do you think any of those media had any interest in George Bush campaigning for the Senate? No. But this is another example of what these guys do to try and screw this thing into this hole, which, and I don't think it fits. Now, let me talk about another piece of evidence that Baker and Hankey like to use, and this is the James Perot memo. Are you familiar with this?
Yes, in stating that George H.W. Bush phoned the FBI to say that he knew that someone had apparently made a claim on JFK's life in the days preceding the assassination.
That's essentially correct. That on the day of the assassination, Bush was in Tyler, Texas. He called into the FBI after he learned that Kennedy had been killed, and he said he remembered someone in his campaign office referring to a guy named James Perot as making a threat against Kennedy. Okay? Now, if you really want to read how this really occurred, okay, then I strongly advise you to read Webster Tarpley's biography of Bush, which I think was published in 1992. I think it's called The Unauthorized Biography of George Bush. Are you familiar with that book? Is that the right title?
Yes, it is. I have not read the book, but I've read excerpts from it, yes.
Okay, I think that's the right title, okay? But anyway, it's online, all right? It's online. And it's a very good book about Bush, all right? He talks about this in his book. And to read what he says about it versus what Baker says about it, or Hankey, is night and day. See, Baker actually tries to say that somehow this never happened, when in fact it did happen. And the Secret Service had a report on this. And a guy actually in Bush's campaign who actually heard it through another party actually went ahead to the Secret Service that day after Bush called it in, and he recognized who Perot was. All right? Okay, now, what these guys do to try and turn this around, I mean, Hankey tries to say something like, well, why would you do that if you were in Tyler, Texas that day? Well, where else was Bush going to do it from? All right, that's where he was. All right, that's where he remembered that some guy in his office, you know, he had heard through some scuttlebutt that he had actually, and this guy really was an extreme rabid right winger. Okay, now, Baker tries to say that this is supposed to establish his alibi as being in Tyler, Texas. Well, here's the problem with that. At the moment of the assassination, okay, Bush was at, I think, the Blackstone Hotel, all right? And his campaign had arranged him, I think it was some kind of local Rotary Club or something, to speak to about 100-some people who were there. Well, why would you need an alibi if you already had 101 witnesses there? Okay? You know, so to me, you know, none of this stuff makes any sense at all.
Right. I don't remember the specifics, but if I remember correctly, I believe Hanke was making the point that the timeline of that was suspicious in that there was not enough time for George Bush to make that phone call.
That's because he changed the timeline. Okay, when he first talked about it, he said Bush had something like an hour and 10 minutes to do it. He then changed it, and now he said he had something like 7 or 8 minutes to do it. Well, 7 or 8 minutes to walk over to a phone, okay, or to go to and pick it up and call the FBI, okay, whatever it is, it doesn't strike me as being a very long time. If Hanke really wants to go ahead and say that this is all a BS story, which is what he's trying to say, then he should go down there and find the guy who was a witness. That's what he should do. He shouldn't read something into a document that's not there. Find the guys who were there and ask them, was Bush here or not? See, that's what you do if you're a real researcher. And I've done this dozens and dozens of times. You go to the source. You go to the primary source. You want to try and find out the truth. You don't try and twist documents around. Okay.
Right. And I think another thing that was brought up in connection with that was apparently new evidence that has emerged that someone fitting a description like George H.W. Bush was arrested coming out of the book depository.
All right, this is what he does with this one. Okay. There's a picture, okay, of a guy standing in front of of course, if Bush is in Tyler, Texas, he can't be in Dealey Plaza. Okay. So there's this picture that people have passed around, and I actually saw this picture. It's Spartacus, okay, which is one of the more frequently, there's a lot of foot traffic at Spartacus. Everybody who looked at this picture, and I didn't register an opinion one way or the other because I just didn't want to get involved, okay, but everybody who looked at that picture, you know, said hands down, because you can, with all the stuff you have today on computers, you know, you can magnify, you can enlarge, you can even twist a picture around, okay, to give you the best possible angle that you possibly can have. No one looking at that picture says it's Bush. It can't be Bush if he's in Tyler, Texas anyway. Okay, then he takes a page out of, I think, Roger Craig's notes, you know, to say, because this is what he's leading to. He's actually trying to say that Bush was arrested that day. That's what he's trying to say. That's what this is leading to. And that somehow the Dallas police covered this up when, in fact, all the records of the people arrested that day were declassified, you know, I think it was 1990. And I think there were something like 13 people who were arrested that day. And the records are right down there. You know, at the Dallas, you know, there's a place, the Dallas City Hall, that's declassified all the police records, okay? And Watkins has now declassified all the DA records. And it's something like 26,000 pages. And you can find out who was arrested that day.
Right, and I believe it was Hanke's assertion that this man, whoever he was not booked, was not charged, was not fingerprinted, but was pursued by the crowd who believed he had something to do with it.
He was pursued. I never saw that. I believe
that's what he said. I have not seen the actual notes.
In Roger
either.
Craig's notes, it says something like, words of the effect, what was the actual word he used? Okay, some operator from Houston was arrested that day. And somehow, Hanke thinks that this is Bush. this is the kind of stuff I'm talking about. If you're going to go ahead and actually be serious 47 years after the fact, okay, and if you're really going to try and do something about this case, all right, and if you're not in it for a hobby, you know, and if you're really interested in who killed Kennedy, this is not the kind of stuff that you enter into the arena if you're really trying to launch a new investigation. And beyond the 50th, which is, you know, 2013, where is there ever going to be any hope? Any event beyond that is going to allow us to have any power to reopen this case. I don't think there is going to be. I think after this, it's essentially over. It's going to be a part of history. Okay? And if you can't make a really good case in 50 years, If you can't make a very solid case that you can present to authorities in 50 years, then you better just, you know, shut your doors and go home. Okay, that's the kind of way I feel about this, and that's the kind of way that a lot of people feel about this. All right? So now, I've discussed, you know, there's Seamus's review at CTK.net, and I did my review of Baker's book at CTK.net, and I went into even a lot more depth than this. Okay, I even talked about what the kind of case that Baker tries to make for the George DeMorin show, which Bush's association with George DeMorin show, which I, in my opinion, is as paper thin as the things that we've already talked about. And let me say this: I was surprised at the reaction I got, because the article was reprinted at Robert Perry's site, the consortium. All right. And because Bob liked the article, and he went ahead and reprinted a kind of abridged version in my review of Family of Secrets. You know, Baker and Hanke, you know, whatever I feel about their work, they've done a good job convincing some people that somehow they're right. Because I had to go ahead, and there were many comments made at Consortium about my review. And I, you know, I'm the kind of guy, okay, I'll answer your questions. What do you want to know? And so I had to just repeat many of the points that I've just made with you, okay? Because, see, if you curtail the background, like if you don't tell anybody that Bush is running for the Senate at that time, okay? If you don't tell anybody that he was in Tyler, Texas at the time, if you don't tell anybody he was addressing a crowd at that time, if you don't tell anybody that picture, if you give it to any objective person, they're not going to say it's Bush. If you say, well, he was arrested that day, and the only thing you have is Roger Craig's notes saying an operator from Houston. Okay, well, that's not really good evidence to nail anybody. Okay, see, if you don't say this stuff, then, of course, you're going to deliver a stilted version of what the facts are. All right? And this is another thing that, you know, we've tried to go ahead and change. You know, what are all the facts? Not just the facts that you want to present, but what are the facts that are contrary to your thesis? Because if you can't counteract what is contrary to your thesis, you know, then you're not being honest with the reader, or in your case, the listener.
All right. Well, okay. I do want to move on to talk about the upcoming 50th anniversary and sort of how we proceed from here. But also, before we leave this topic, I think something else that would be beneficial for the listeners is to hear your side of the story, because, of course, another aspect of this story is that Hanke apparently requested space to respond to the dark legacy of John Hanke on CTKA.net, but was denied. And so I think the listeners might be interested in knowing sort of the reasoning behind that.
Sure. And I told him what I just told Paul Chambers, because we just had Martin Hay did a negative review of his book Headshot. And I essentially say this to everybody who asks. It's a general rule we have. You know, if we went ahead and granted, you know, equal space to every author whose book we criticized, all right, and then I would have to go ahead and give the originating author the counterpoint, we'd be spending all of our time doing this kind of thing. Because we write many, many, many negative reviews. And I don't want to get into this kind of thing. Okay? The only time that I ever made an exception to that rule, okay, was in the case of Alex Jones. That's the only time I ever made an exception to that rule. Okay? Because Seamus did a discussion of Alex Jones. That particular article got more emails, you know, and raised more of a ruckus, you know, than anything that we ever did. And so it was literally, you know, people were, you know, I had to answer. So that's the only time I ever made an exception to that rule, okay? And it's the only time I'm ever going to make an exception to that rule. So that's generally the rule we have. Now, Hanke went ahead. See, there's so many JFK forums out there that you don't need CTK.net to do a reply. And so what Hanke did is he went over to JFK Murder Solved, which is run by a guy named Wim Dankbar, okay, from Europe, I think, and he posted his reply there. And his reply, I thought, you know, was so, you know, so so mischaracterizing of what Seamus's essay was all about that I went ahead and replied to him at that forum. Okay? And that was what I was talking about at the beginning. What he did on his website is he did not include, okay, my second counter to him. That's not on his website. He literally left that out. Okay?
All right. Well, I think that does address the point anyway. So I certainly leave it to the listeners out there to go and look that up for themselves if they're more interested in that. But personally, I'm more interested in the facts about the case. And especially, as you point out, as we're coming up to the 50th anniversary, which is going to be obviously an incredibly important time, probably, as you say, the last really possible opportunity for even beginning to open a real reinvestigation. So I guess, how is CTKA proceeding towards the 50th anniversary, and what do you envision unfolding in the next few years?
Well, obviously, there's two things that appear to be working against us right now. Number one, which I'm sure you're aware of, there's HBO is going to do a documentary miniseries on Bugliosi's book, Reclaiming History, which is going to be produced by Tom Hanks and Gary Goldsman. And that's going to be a very serious problem, because Reclaiming History is almost a ludicrously one-sided version of what happened. All right? So if there is not any kind of equal time on that show, or any kind of opportunity to rebut, that's something that we're really going to have to work hard to overcome. Now, the second really bad thing is that Leonardo DiCaprio has apparently optioned the book, which I was talking about earlier, the Hartman Waldron book, Ultimate Sacrifice, in its sequel, Legacy of Secrecy. Now, if this actually goes through, what you're going to have is the equivalent of a double-barreled shotgun blast, okay, one on TV and one in the movie theaters, with what is essentially two disinformation stories of different stripes, okay, about the Kennedy case. So this is very, very daunting, to say the least, and we have to come up with something to overcome this, all right? And so Leno Sanek, who does Black Op Radio, is sponsoring a conference in Hawaii, which will be in April. And that one of the things about this conference is that to organize a counterattack to this kind of stuff that's going to be happening. Because if this is all that's out there, if this is all that's going to be out there, then we really don't have much of a chance to go ahead and reopen the case. Now, as I said earlier, there is a possibility with Mr. Watkins as DA. And in fact, I know someone who's actually been talking to somebody in his office, which is really amazing because, you know, before Watkins, you know, they wouldn't even talk to you. They wouldn't even pick up the phone if you wanted to talk about JFK. All right. But apparently, according to my source, there is a person in Watkins' office, who will accept calls on this. And according to my source, he was on the phone with him for quite a long time. You know, so they're not averse to talking about this with you, which is really, really good. You know, so that's one angle that we can go ahead and proceed. The other angle, of course, is trying to get a documentary made on our side, okay, for to counteract Bugliosi's documentary. And there are some people that we have. You know, there's like Jesse Ventura, who did an hour-long, actually a 15-minute documentary for True TV a couple weeks ago, which was okay. All right. There's Oliver Stone, who we can turn to. And there's also Kevin Costner, who has a real interest, you know, in these kind of things. So these are kind of people that we should be working towards, you know, to actually work on something like this, to present the very best evidence, declassified by the ARB. Because the evidence we have now that the ARB declassified is pretty much a rock-solid case that Oswald did not do it. We can now prove this, you know, to a point that the case against Oswald is just absolutely preposterous. And we can show where the evidence, we can actually show now where the evidence has been falsified. And we can pretty much show not only where it was falsified, but who did it. Okay? So it's very, very solid, you know, what we can prove now, all right, as far as how bad the Warren Commission was. All right, and how they basically essentially lied to the public. And we can prove that they lied to the public now, which is a really big, that's a really big jump. It's one thing to say, as Mark Lane does in his book, Russia Judgment, that, you know, the evidence does not justify the conclusion. And he did, Hugh Hammond, Sylvia Marr, for example, did very good jobs on that, okay, in their early books, Russia Judgment and Accessories After the Fact. But now we can actually, like, for instance, let me give you one example. We can now prove that I'm sure you're familiar with what CE-399 is, right?
As a matter of fact, I am not. Please tell me and the listeners.
Okay, CE-399 is the so-called magic bullet.
Okay. Ah, okay. All right.
This is the bullet the Warren Commission says went through both Kennedy and Connally and was found on a stretcher at Parkland Hospital. All right. And as everyone knows, it's very hard to believe it was this bullet because this bullet is essentially unmarked. All right. It's almost lost no volume from its mass. All right. And it doesn't and to go through two bones, you know, and all the layers of tissue and blood, et cetera, very hard to believe that this. Well, we can now show that CE-399 was substituted, and it was substituted that day. In fact, by the end of the day. All right, and we can show this through the witness testimony of the two people who actually picked up the bullet, Tomlinson, Daryl Tomlinson, and O.P. Wright, who say that that is not the bullet. We can show that the FBI deliberately lied about this. This is what is new. Hoover deliberately lied about this, and he made up a meeting between the FBI and Tomlinson and Wright, in which they were supposed to present the bullet to them, and they said it was, words of the effect, it was not dissimilar to what they, well, that never happened. We can prove that. Further, we can now also prove that Investigator Frazier at FBI headquarters was in receipt of CE-399 at 7:30 that evening. Well, but the problem with that is that the agent who delivered CE-399 to Frazier did not get the bullet until 8:05 at the White House. So obviously, if Frazier was in receipt of the bullet at 7:30, it was not the bullet that was going to be in transit to him, because that bullet was not in possession of the FBI agent who gave it to him till 35 minutes later. So obviously, we can now prove with documents that CE-399 was never fired that day. And with CE-399 never fired that day, the single bullet theory is now finally and fatally confined to the dustbin of history. It never happened, which of course means it was a conspiracy. Without CE-399, okay, even the people on the Warren Commission will tell you there's more than one assassin. All right? So that's the kind of stuff we can prove now.
So what about the House Select Committee on Assassinations?
What do I think of what their work was?
What do you think of the ultimate conclusion that they came to?
Well, if you read the declassified documents of the HSCA, it's pretty clear that Blakey was essentially trying to, what's the best way to say it, limit the damage, do a limited hangout, okay? Because if you read the declassified files, the evidence that the House Select Committee had was really extremely powerful, all right, that, you know, that there was a conspiracy, all right? Just the Mexico City report, all right, is very, very powerful, which, of course, was classified, all right? And so what Blakey did, he was trying to steer everything to first Oswald did it, and then when the Dictabelt tape came in, do I have to explain that? Should I explain what that is?
Yes, I'm familiar with it, but you should explain it for the listeners.
All right, okay. This was one of the motorcycle riders in the motorcade that day, had an open mic, all right, and you could actually hear the actual bullets fired that day. And so they brought this to two experts in the field, two highly thought of experts in the field, all right, and they came to the conclusion that one of the bullets, at least one, came from the so-called picket fence or the grassy knoll, you know, in front of Kennedy, all right? And there's been more evidence about this that's come out of late. And Blakey tried to say that there were only four shots on the tape. Well, Donald Thomas actually talked to Blakey, and he went ahead and reexamined the evidence, and there's actually five shots on the tape. Now, there's been a ton of controversy about this ever since. Okay. Well, what Blakey tried to say is he tried to say that this fourth shot from the picket fence missed. Okay. It actually missed. Now, if you've ever been to Dealey Plaza and you go up to the sixth floor and then you go to the picket fence and you go ahead and take a look at both shots, well, it's very, very hard to believe that Oswald or whoever was in the sixth floor could have hit Kennedy and the guy right in front of him missed. But see, that's the kind of thing that Blakey was intent on doing. So they came to the conclusion, and I think this is the way they worded it in the report, was that it was a 95% probability of a conspiracy, but the fatal shot still came from behind. Now, we know today, of course, that what Blakey did with the House Select Committee is he realized he had all this evidence that pointed to a much wider conspiracy. And he realized he had a lot of people on the committee who were convinced that it was a much wider conspiracy. So what he did is he shut down the committee, I think, in Christmas of 1978. And he kept behind a kind of skeleton crew of, like, I think it was four people. And he was, of course, one of the four. And his trusted aide, Dick Billings, was one of the four. And it's these four people who actually wrote the report. All right? And they essentially stilted everything. You know, if you go ahead and take a look at what the report says, then you go ahead and take a look at what the declassified files say, you know, it's roughly, not quite as bad, but it's roughly the same thing as a Warren Commission, all right? They tapered everything to limit the really strong evidence that was in the declassified files, and it was essentially became a cover-up, a different type of cover-up, but still a cover-up of what the true circumstances were, all right? Like, for example, the House Select Committee says that contrary to popular belief, that there really wasn't any hole in the back of Kennedy's head, as the witnesses at Parkland said they saw. You know, and they say because contrary to the witnesses at Parkland, there were many witnesses at Bethesda, where Kennedy's body went that night, who say they didn't see this. And so since the people at Parkland only had the body in front of them for like 20 minutes, you know, and the people at Bethesda had it for 3 or 4 hours, you know, their testimony takes precedence. Okay, well, what Gary Aguilar found out was that the witnesses at Bethesda saw the same thing that the witnesses at Parkland saw. You know, they all said they saw this rather blown-out hole, this, as they call, avulsed hole, that was at the back of Kennedy's head. So, and Gary had put a chart together, and you got like now 43 witnesses, okay, saying between Parkland and Bethesda that they actually saw this hole in the back of Kennedy's head. And in fact, one of the higher-up doctors that night, Robert Canada, was interviewed by Michael Kurtz, I think in the 1980s, and he told Kurtz about this blasted-out hole in the back of Kennedy's head. And Kurtz asked him, he goes, well, what are you talking about? The autopsy report says that there was a small hole at the bottom of Kennedy's head, okay, a tiny hole. And Canada says, no, no, no. That autopsy report was rewritten, okay, to cover up the fact that there was this blasted out hole in the back of Kennedy's head. And I know because I saw it. All right. And but he made Kurt's promise not to print that in any book until after he was dead. Okay, so Kurtz printed it in his book, The JFK Assassination Debates, which I think came out in like 2003 or 2004. Okay, so that's one of the things that Blakey covered up because, and of course, I don't have to tell you why that's important. It's because a blasted out hole in the back of Kennedy's head would go counter to the idea that all the shots came from behind. All right, and that's because when usually when entrance holes come in, they leave small, kind of very circular holes. Okay, but when it emerges, it leaves large, you know, jagged-edged holes. And that's what this hole in the back of the head was, which is strongly indicative of a shot from the front. And so that's why Blakey did what he did. All right? So that's just one example.
Absolutely.
Of what he did.
Well, I'm sorry to take us on that diversion. I mean, we really could talk about this for hundreds and hundreds of hours. But at any rate, getting back to the point of the coming 50th anniversary, what would you suggest for listeners out there who are concerned about this and who would like to see something resembling the truth represented at the time of the 50th anniversary? What do you suggest that people can do to help make that happen?
Okay, well, there's a couple things they can do. If you want to go to Black Op Radio and sign up for that conference. You know, there's going to be organizing committees of what things we can do to go ahead and get ready, you know, for the 2013. Also, what you could probably do is go ahead and either write a letter or fax or something, okay, to Craig Watkins, who is the DA down in Dallas, okay, and go ahead and ask him if he would consider, you know, reopening the JFK case. The third thing you should do is either write HBO or write Playtone or Leonardo DiCaprio's productions, which that's Appian Way in West Hollywood. Okay, and you can look these all up on the internet and object to them doing something like this for 2013. So that's three things that you could probably do.
All right. Well, certainly one person is facing an uphill struggle doing this, but if enough people become involved, it becomes hopefully a tidal wave that will move us towards where we want to be. So on that note, tell people again about the website and how they can access your work.
Okay. The website is ctka.net. Okay. And Black Op Radio, just punch in Black Op Radio. I do a show there like every other week. All right. And thank you very much for having me on. Okay, and I hope I managed to enlighten some of your listeners.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for taking the time to join us today, and good luck in your future endeavors.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Corbett.
And just as an addendum to this interview with Jim DiEugenio of CTKA.net, I'd like to append this, which is a recording of Seamus Coogan. Unfortunately, we weren't able to bring him up during the Jim DiEugenio conversation, but Seamus Coogan was the author of the Hanke article that we discussed in this interview. So, Seamus, thank you for joining us today, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, thank you very much for enduring with me. well, where do I start? First off, I saw the Martin Sheen docudrama. I was always a docudrama, just a drama when I was a little kid, with Sally Field, JFK. And I was about nine, I think. And I always thought it was great that Lee Harvey Oswald got shot by Ruby. I think so that was cool. But my mother always used to say to me, Seamus, there's something more to it. And that was a really interesting little part. And I didn't really click onto me until I got a little bit older. My parents were politically active, and so I started to read a lot more and everything like that. And then I saw The Men Who Killed Kennedy, and of course I saw the Zapruder film, and it was about 1991 or 1992. And it literally took my head off, a bit like Kennedy's, really. When I saw it, I was like, there was no way that shot could have come from the sixth floor window in the depository. And that was it for me. And so I looked into it, got more into it, and I came across a really wonderful thing, and this led me to Jim DiEugenio and CTKA. It was about 1996, and it was by a man called Carl Oglesby, who said, We've got to be careful with the Kennedy assassination. We must be careful of running off into the ether of our own imaginations, and that really stuck with me. And so I've been looking at, you know, who was the gunman on the knoll and who were the tramps and all this kind of thing, and then it just struck me. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, this is going to be some wild ride. And the thing about Hanke, about all this was that when I started out, after I saw the men who killed Kennedy, then I saw JFK, was that I knew that there were people out there that knew a hell of a lot more than me. And I made it my mission to find those sources. And of course, when Carl Oglesby said that as well, that reinforced my journey. And so a few years later, I came across CTKA and Probe. And that was basically how it all began. And I met up with Jim DiEugenio in 2006 when I went to America. And I've really got to thank Lisa Pease, another person that Hanke has accused of nefarious dealings. And that was how it began for me, actually. So, yeah, that was, I made my mark then. Then a few years later, I did my first article, CTKA. The first one being, James, sorry, this is a real mouthful. The first one was the John Hanke piece. And how I got into the Hanke piece was quite interesting. I'd seen it on YouTube, I think, and I thought, I'll watch it. And I thought, this is really odd. The facts here aren't quite straight. And so I thought to myself, oh, this is pretty stink. So I just thought, I wrote it off. And then a couple of weeks later, I actually heard John Hanke at some point on, I think it was either an archive show I listened to on Black Hawk Radio, or I don't think it was a recent one. And I heard John Hanke promoting and talking about JFK too. And what really struck it for me was when he made a call about Prescott Bush actually being the secret power behind Alan Dulles and actually running the Central Intelligence Agency. And for anybody that's studied the Kennedy assassination, you'd know that that sort of call is pretty wild, because most people, I would say, within the Kennedy research nexus, the people that have been at it for a while, and, you know, you respected people like your Jim DiEugenios, like your Lisa Teasers, Larry Hancock's, and there's a whole group of them that are really good, like Jim Douglas's, a lot of them, I don't know what I'm missing your names, there's so many good ones, would put Alan Dulles either there or thereabouts, okay? And none of them have ever really discussed Prescott Bush in any way, shape or form, as we've discussed in the Hanke 2 review that we did. And that came after. And so that was it. And that was how it started. And then so Jim, I think he's told you, Jim started to get emails from me going, hey, did that happen? No, I was saying, look, this is looking really bad. And are there any questions you would like to ask me at this point in time before I completely run out of breath?
That was quite a mouthful.
Sorry, mate. That was a Hankean mouthful.
Well, that does corroborate what Jim was saying about the way that article came about. So tell us about... So that was your first article with CTKA. What other work have you done with them?
Well, since then... what happened with John Hanke was really quite... It was accidental. In a way, for Jim it was, because I'd done some articles and just looking into some of the more libertarian right-wing kind of conspiracy stuff, and I became really interested in that, because somewhere through that nexus was coming some disinformation, I think, some myths that had long been kind of killed off, started to emerge after 9/11, you see. And so I became really interested in the culture and what was happening around there. And quite by accident, I think Jim had been really looking into some contemporary JFK issues at the time, like a guy called Lamar Waldron had brought out this really awful book called Ultimate Sacrifice. And the thing that Jim found, I think, was that it was actually infiltrating some really good research, like some good researchers were actually kind of getting taken in by some of it. And while he was looking at that, I think his attention had been, his gaze had been taken away from the current climate outside of the JFK thing. And so once I showed him Hanke, and then we started to discuss this, I think I think Jim then realized, hey, in actual fact, there are probably some bigger problems out there that also need to be confronted. So I think my next piece after Hanky was a sizable piece I also did on Alex Jones. And we were discussing this prior to us recording. And some of your listeners, if they ever read it, they actually might be a little bit confronted by some of the opinions that I have about Alex Jones in that piece. And maybe I could talk to you at some other later date about that, James. And but just on from there, I've done a review on Jesse Ventura's TV show, and that's just come up. Also, too, there is another one that I did on an interesting fellow by the name of James Bamford. Now, he did a famous book by the name of Puzzle Palace, and he did a recent book. Oh, I forget the name.
I do know who you're referring to, but I forget the name of the book at the moment as well.
Well, he came out in 2001, and it was just basically about Operation Northwoods and how that's been conflated with the Kennedy assassination. And most often wrongly, you see. And so that's an interesting article there, too, if people would like to read that. And if there's any interest, you could talk to me about that at some other stage as well. So there's a few things that I've got in place and a few things I've got in the pipe, so to speak.
All right. Okay. Well, I think that will serve as an addendum to this interview at any rate. I obviously there are some perhaps differences of agreement between what the work that I'm doing and that type of work. But at any rate, I'm certainly not running any type of cult, and I'm not asking anyone to
saying or promoting. No, sorry to interrupt you too. No, and I think it's really important, though, too, that we actually try and find agreements, isn't it, really? I think that that's part of it. And those sorts of things, and just take it, you know what I mean? You don't have to like everything that CTKA does, but just have a look, and those sorts of things. But it's really great that you've got an open mind enough to actually let us talk, which I think is really great, and it's a credit to you and your show.
Well, I absolutely do agree that we do need to find the points that we can agree on and that we can work together on, because without that, it's just going to turn into some sort of religious cult where everyone has to believe the same thing, and that's definitely not what I'm about.
Yes, absolutely. And I completely agree. And it's just, if you want a yardstick for Kennedy assassination research, or just to see how good researchers work at it, though, I really would advise you go and check out CTKA, just to anybody, you know, and just see how it goes, because believe it or not, we are all betting on the same team.
All right, Seamus Coogan. Well, given that you are in New Zealand, I guess perhaps just before we go, we can talk a little bit about the Christchurch Star.
Oh, geez. Oh. I'll do that classic John Hankey line that he gave you. How long have you got? 2-3 hours? No. The Christchurch Star is a real anomaly, okay? First off, Fletcher Prouty never actually said that New Zealand got the news ahead of the rest of the world. It's been edited quite badly in some documentaries, and it wasn't made very clear in the film JFK. And I've been having some really good talks with Leno Sanek about this and over the years, and I've been looking into it for 5 years. And so New Zealand didn't get the news ahead of the rest of the world at all. It was just because of the timelines and everything like that, we may have had the first printed accounts of it, okay? When Fletcher Prouty picked up the newspaper and everything like that is irrelevant, okay? Even he says that. So the issue is when the news actually came out, okay? So everybody around the world got the news around at the same point in time. But in my research and everything that, and hopefully one day I can go into it a little bit more in depth with you, I actually think Fletcher Prouty was actually correct. I think that there actually was a cover story put in place. But the first thing people have to realise about the cover story, though, James, is that Lee Harvey Oswald was himself the cover story, and everything else came and fitted around him. And, of course, for me, looking into it, it's become more and more apparent that without Operation Mockingbird running alongside the Kennedy assassination, I don't think a lot of what would have happened would have been possible for the conspirators. So that opens up a whole other kettle of fish. And if people are really interested in finding out a little bit about it, I've got my first piece about the Christchurch Star, which is pretty much just technical, boring data, and that's on my mate Greg Parker's Reopen Kennedy Case website. It's pretty badly edited and it needs a little bit of a revamp, but that's just a precursor to what I'm doing in parts 2 and 3. So hopefully when they come out, I can talk to you then about that a little bit more.
Well, I certainly would be interested in that because it is, I think, a very interesting piece of the puzzle, and a very small one, but still a very interesting piece of the puzzle at any rate. So, and it does lead into a lot of very important areas to research.
Yes, all right. Well, at least it was great, mate. Yeah, cool.
Excellent. Okay, let's leave it there. Well, Seamus Coogan, thank you for joining us today from New Zealand.
No, thank you very much too, James. I'll see you later.